Hi, I'm Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian's books website. Since we recorded today's programme, the death has been announced of J.D. Salinger, author of the perennial bestseller of adolescent ennui, The Catcher in the Rye, and, since his decisive withdrawal from public life in the 1960s, literature's most famous recluse. Here with me in the studio to discuss his legacy is Guardian writer Zan Brooks. Hi, Zan.
Hi there, Sarah.
Salinger's best known by everyone, I think, for Catcher in the Rye. But for many people, this is a book that you read in school, that you come across when you're 15 and then probably move on from after that. Do you think it sort of stands up as a book for adults as well as for teenagers?
I think it's certainly best if it hits you in your youth. I remember reading it when I was 14 and coming to it totally cold, and it was like a bomb going off. It was like the sort of the gateway to the world that I was just entering and trying to kind of navigate. I thought it was absolutely astonishing. And then I remember lending it to somebody and never getting it back, and then rereading it again in my early 20s and thinking it wasn't half as good as I'd remembered it. And I think because you have such a personal connection to the character of Holden Caulfield that you identify with him in your teens, and then when you read later on, you don't. And I thought suddenly he was an idiot and I didn't like him. And so the book then didn't work for me. But then I read it for a third time, maybe about 10 years ago, and I loved it again. I think I had the distance on it that you maybe need. And then it just seemed like an incredibly poignant and well-observed account of adolescence, as opposed to the world that I was living in at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think I sort of had the same reaction, but missing out the first step, probably. Because when I read it at 15, I read it as a school text, and I didn't really like it.
Maybe it's more of a boy's book.
Oh, that's such a dangerous thing to say. But when I read it in my late 20s, early 30s, I picked it up again because I think my younger brother was studying it. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant and sort of said a lot more to me then than...
Right.
When I read it the first time. But he's also published a lot of short fiction as well. And for sort of Salinger connoisseurs, I think this is the thing that people hold up as, you know, if you want to like Salinger, you should read this. And do you know his short fiction well?
I prefer the short fiction, I think. And the short fiction I came to a bit later, I think the book Nine Stories, it's published as Nine Stories in the US, and I think it's Foresme with Love and Squalor, is perhaps one of the great single collections of short fiction that anyone has ever written.
Why do you say that?
I think the economy of it, his confidence, his grace. He has one of the best ears for dialogue ever, and the way people talk and what they say and what they don't say and what they mean, and just his beautiful discretion and the kind of the epiphanies in these very small, sculpted, perfectly honed stories are wonderful. The title story, Foresme of Love and Squalor, is about a World War II veteran, obviously kind of based on Salinger himself, as a lot of his characters are, and his encounter with a little English girl in a village where he's been stationed. And it's utterly beautiful and has one of the most kind of moving final pages of any story, I think. And the other great classic is A Perfect Day for Banana Fish.
That was his first story, wasn't it?
Which is the first story in there, but it's almost the last story of the character of Seymour Glass, who's the sort of the figurehead of the Glass family, which was Salinger's great kind of perennial fascination, this family of sort of gilded, fragile, delicate flowers in New York. And A Perfect Day for Banana Fish is an incredibly shocking story, but again, the dialogue is amazing. There's this encounter on the beach where the character of Seymour Glass is fracturing. He's having a breakdown, and it's so beautifully done, and just kind of immerses you in his world.
And this family, the Glass family, these are the family that turned up in the Royal Tenenbaums, the film The Royal Tenenbaums. Is that right?
Well, in a kind of heavily disguised way.
They're figures that with whom we're very familiar in American fiction, these sort of brilliant, fragile Upper West Siders.
I think in The Guardian it was either Joyce Carol Oates or Annie Proulx was saying that Salinger was the great chronicler of American rootlessness, and I think the Glass family were that. They're basically these very bright people who have material possessions, but they're maybe looking for some extra spiritual dimension, something more. There has to be something more to life, and more often than not they don't find it.
And this was obviously all we have of Salinger's life post about 1960, when he withdrew from public life, are the various lawsuits that he issued against people who he thought were trying to infringe on his work. And also a couple of memoirs, one from the woman with whom he had an affair, Joyce Maynard, and one from his daughter. And both in both of these memoirs, it comes up this idea that he is also someone who's looking for something. and looking for it in religion, often in Buddhism, in sort of weird fad diets. How much do you think that the myth of the man has influenced our view of his fiction?
I think a huge amount. I think it supports the view that Salinger was his characters, that he was Seymour Glass and that he was Holden Caulfield, that he was this super bright, precocious kid who kind of wanted the attention, but then when the attention was turned on him, couldn't cope with it and ran away and retreated from, you know, the world of phony bastards. And that is maybe the romantic interpretation of his retreat. Maybe the truer version of all hermits and recluses is that they're also paranoid, twitchy, possibly unpleasant people. And he did guard his privacy. There are a sort of unsavory stories about his relationships with young women who he kind of discarded at will. And all of that, I think, maybe contaminates the view of him as the great sort of ascetic hermit who kind of went off into the hills and turned his back on the world.
And obviously the big question now is that, the rumour goes, he's been writing all of this time, colour-coded manuscripts, some for publication, some for not, and they've just been building up in his house. Would you like to see stuff published now, or do you think we should leave well alone? And
I think there's always going to be a fascination. Because he was such a master prose stylist that you of course want to see what he's been doing, and why hasn't he been showing it anyway? I'm not sure whether it's brilliant or cowardly that he's not. Maybe it can be both, that he hasn't published anything. He's been writing purely for himself. I think that the whole weirdness of his later life kind of makes me doubt the quality of the work that he produced, because, you know, of course writers need solitude in order to work, but they also surely need to be open to the world a bit, to have something to write about. And I guess the horror is that you're just going to get these kind of terrible solipsistic voyages through his own psyche, or, you know, 20 novels about an old man living out in New Hampshire.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. Zan, thanks very much for coming in to talk to us. And now we'll go back to the rest of this week's Books podcast.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. Ask the American writer Barbara Ehrenreich to smile, and she might well send you off with a flea in your ear. She tells us why she's crusading against the pressure to be cheerful, even if your world has fallen in on your head. Publishers are certainly not the most cheery people at the moment. We'll be finding out what the impact of the launch of Apple's new iPad reading tablet has had on their spirits. But first, the Costa Prize, which was won this week by a poet, Christopher Reed, for a moving collection chronicling the illness and death of his wife, the actor Lucinda Gayne. We begin with a reading of two sections from a long poem, The Unfinished.
How bright the wit! The circumstance-mocking, theatrical badinage burned. To a friend concerned she might be tired, I heard her say, "Exhausted people leave the hospice all day, and I just carry on talking." To another, catching a glimpse of her own undimmable spirit, "I'm being radiant again, aren't I?" It was inspired. Brave, funny and subtle of her to interpret the role of patient so flat against type. Cheering her nurses, feeding advice and support to friends, encouraging her husband to address his possible future with something of her hope. It's not in his nature, but he can try. When the brush had started tugging out random tufts and clumps of springy brown hair from her outgrown bob, she asked me to shave the whole lot off. Fractious, half-hearted, I took on the job. Began maladroitly, then finished it with a perfectionist's care. Revealed a handsome, unabashed smoothness I couldn't stop wanting to fondle and kiss. Wasn't it something that the cup of my hand and curve of her clean scalp should turn out to be such an intimate fit? The pull to palp and pamper that round shape, to learn its lineaments and feel the hint of a hint of light stubble pushing through, was irresistible. Virgin landscape, so neat and so new.
Chris Moran reading from Christopher Reed's Costa-winning collection of poems, A Scattering. Immediately after Tuesday's award ceremony, The Guardian's Mark Brown spoke to Christopher and asked him how he felt.
I'm delighted, and I feel a little humbled as well, because I don't necessarily believe that I was any better than the other books that were nominated for this prize. Nonetheless, yeah, primarily, I'm thrilled to bits.
Now, this was about as personal a book, a collection of poems to write, as is possible, because it's about your wife who died in 2005. Was that difficult?
It was difficult to write, yes, for reasons that I hope I can explain. I just needed to write about her honestly and clearly and truthfully, and to get all of that down on the page whilst still grieving and having a slightly muddled mind for that reason. Yes, that was a challenge, but I think probably the attempt to write the book was a good intellectual discipline and an emotional discipline, more importantly, and I was glad to, in the end, accomplish what I did. There's lots more I could say about my wife, but I put it all in a little box, as it were, and there it is for a while.
I found myself, when I was reading it, I sort of did break into tears spontaneously. I mean, what was it like writing it?
Well, you can't weep and write at the same time. Obviously, I did plenty of weeping, and still occasionally do. But when you're at your desk trying to be clear-headed and honest, tears get in the way. So you try not to be not to call up those emotions in yourself. But obviously, if I communicate in such a way as to transmit that emotion to readers, then that's really what I should be trying to do, and I'm pleased, although it sounds terrible, to be making people cry.
You did. And tell me how the last poets to win this prize were Seamus Heaney and Ted Hughes. How important is it that a poet wins, and how important is it for poetry?
Well, I don't know that it's important that a poet wins, but I was very fortunate to be associated with both Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney as their editor, and in fact edited a couple of the books of theirs that received the Whitbread Prize, as it then was. And I was fully involved in the excitement of the showbiz type excitement of all of that. If I can follow behind in my quieter way, I'm pleased.
And it does an awful lot for... am I right in saying, I mean, all the books have sold quite well, but it's fair to say that your collection of poems has probably sold the least of all five of them.
That's probably the case, yes. That's the way of poetry books. But we'll see what happens next.
Barbara Ehrenreich is best known for her classic work of undercover reportage Nickel and Dimed, for which she went to live among the poor of urban America. She's also written a history of collective joy, Dancing in the Streets. But then she developed breast cancer and found herself coming frown to smile with the cheer merchants of American society, those Panglossians who say things like, chemotherapy's not so bad, it makes you lose weight and wrinkles. Here's a reading from her account of this experience in Smile or Die, How Positive Thinking Fooled America and the World.
Writing in 2007, New York Times health columnist Jane Brody faithfully reflected the near-universal bright-siding of breast cancer. She gave a nod to the downside of breast cancer and cancer generally. Quote, it can cause considerable physical and emotional pain and lasting disfigurement. It may even end in death, close quote. But for the most part, her column was a veritable ode to the uplifting effects of cancer, and especially breast cancer. She quoted bike racer and testicular cancer survivor Lance Armstrong saying, cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me, and cited a woman asserting that, quote, breast cancer has given me a new life. Breast cancer was something I needed to experience to open my eyes to the joy of living. I now see more of the world than I was choosing to see before I had cancer. Breast cancer has taught me to love in the purest sense, close quote. Betty Rollin, one of the first women to go public with her disease, was enlisted to testify that she has, quote, realized that the source of my happiness was, of all things, cancer. That cancer had everything to do with how good the good parts of my life were.
That was Barbara Ehrenreich reading from Smile or Die. She came into The Guardian earlier this month to talk about the book with Lindsay Irvin. He began by asking her what it was initially that alerted her to the downside of positive thinking.
Late 2000, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I, you know, was looking for support and information, and I waded out into the web and visited all the websites I could and, you know, made connections to people. But what I found was all these exhortations all the time to be positive. If life hands you lemons, make lemonade, all the way to embracing the disease as if it were a kind of gift that somehow you're going to come out of cancer more evolved, more spiritual, perhaps more feminine and sensitive. None of those things happened to me, I have to mention. I just got meaner and meaner.
And there is also the suggestion that it's sort of your job. And if you want to get better, you have to embrace that kind of upbeat.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is all supposed to be for your own good. With my bad attitude, the disease could only worsen. And the only way to fight the disease was to just, work constantly on fighting every negative thought and being happier and happier. Now, I want to just say, it was not clear-cut at the time, but it's pretty clear-cut now that attitude does nothing to improve your survival rate from several kinds of cancer that have been studied, including breast cancer.
Despite the fact, I mean, it's more or less kind of mainstream accepted wisdom.
It's absolute conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, say, oh, yeah, well, you want to boost your immune system is what they'll say. And a good attitude boosts your immune system, which then fights the cancer. Well, actually, I have a PhD in cellular immunology. And I know that, one, cancer doesn't fought by the immune system. The immune system just fights foreign invaders. And also that there's very, very little evidence that being, quote, positive boosts your immune system. Certainly being depressed and stressed out compromises it, but not the other way.
Some people, a lot of people listening to this perhaps, might think that this kind of relentlessly upbeat, positive, can-do sort of attitude is just being American. That's not quite your sense, is it?
No, I think it is very much part of the American national character, if I could say that. I hate the idea of a national character, but it is part of our identity in the world. It's part of the way we're seen as sort of simple-minded, smiley-faced people. And we tend to see Europeans, for example, and Asians as somewhat devious, hard to read, gloomy, possibly decadent types compared to us, you know, who are so upbeat. I think it's a strange cultural transition to make, actually, if you were to move to the United States. I've heard this from, just in the time I've been here in London, the culture clash sometimes when people will be expected by corporate superiors in America to be, emanating not just, hard work and all that, but passion, joy,
And everything must be awesome.
Yes.
Do you think this is encroached deeper into the culture in recent years.
In the 80s and 90s, corporations began to use motivational speakers and positive thinking gurus, especially in an age of downsizing, because you could tell the people who are being laid off, just much as cancer victims are told, hey, it's not a bad thing to be laid off. You're actually, this is a growth experience. You're actually in transition to something better. You know, the other use of it in this recession, too, has been to get more and more, extract more and more work out of the survivors of layoffs.
The collapse of the economy, which positive thinking you diagnosed was partly responsible for, will that have dented the culture of positive thinking, do you think?
I'm doing my best to dent it. I am impressed by how many people in the United States have written to me to say, thank God someone said it. That's gratifying. So I think there's a backlash in progress, and I will do my best to foment it.
That was Barbara Ehrenreich. Smile or Die is published by Granter and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Few of you can be unaware that this week Apple launched their latest computing device, the iPad. Will it prove to be the end of the publishing industry as we know it? Or is it just another technological gimmick? With me to discuss it are The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur, and Jamie Bing, managing director of the publisher Canongate. Welcome both. First, Charles, nobody's actually had a chance to test drive it yet, but what do you make of it?
Well, Bobby Johnson, our technology correspondent, had a play with it, and the various people who were in San Francisco for the launch have tried it. The reaction they've had is that it's very fast, actually. They say that web surfing and so on is very quick because it's got a processor built by Apple. I think the interesting thing is the screen and the quality of the screen. It's not that dramatic, but of course it's a colour screen. It's going to look a lot nicer than the Kindle, and as a device just on its own, it looks a lot nicer than the Kindle. The price is rather higher, obviously, but the demonstration, you know, demonstrations can always be a bit like magic and magic tricks, but it certainly looks interesting, and the way that it allows people to buy books, basically just the same way you can buy a track from the iTunes store, it's just a sort of a quick click and there you are, is very interesting, I think.
It's bigger than the Kindle, isn't it? I mean, it's not exactly... It's A4 size, isn't it?
The screen size itself is 9.7 inches, so the usable screen size is actually the same as the Kindle.
But as an object to carry around...
It is larger, yes.
Now, Jamie, are you bracing yourself for this, or do you think it's going to be irrelevant to you?
It's certainly not going to be irrelevant. I don't think it's going to be irrelevant. But as Charles says, until you actually feel it and start using it, just quite how big the adoption of it's going to be, I don't know. And I'm a big iPhone fan and use it a great deal and read a lot on it.
Do you read?
Sure, I don't read full-length novels on it, but, you know, I've read, someone sent me that Martin Luther King amazing letter that he wrote from Birmingham jail, which actually is about 5,000 words long. I read the whole thing on it, partly because it's so incredible, the letter. And but I think it's going to be very significant, not just because of what it is as a kind of new vehicle through which people can download and buy and read ebooks, and I think as a publisher that's something that I welcome, and I think it's also doing something important in terms of the route to market for publishers via the iBook store, which I think is if it's as easy as the iTunes kind of customer experiences or the App Store for that matter, then I think it's going to have a huge impact on ebooks.
Charles, do you think that this is going to start a rush for lots of new versions of this from different manufacturers?
New versions of what sort of slate-style computers?
Readers, yes.
It's really hard to make an impact, actually. You know, lots of companies have been doing it, and there was a big show earlier this month, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, and lots of companies offer tablets. Did you hear about them? Don't think you did. You know, even though, you know, we did our best to cover them, but the fact is simply that, you know, no one makes a splash quite like Apple does these days. It does remind me a bit of the iPhone and the iPod early on, the sort of way we're talking about it, which is that a lot of people are critiquing it before they've actually really had hands on it. This, exactly the same happened with the iPod, exactly the same happened with the iPhone. But the other interesting thing is that with the iPod and with the iPhone, Apple wasn't the first into the market. It wasn't the first into digital music players, wasn't the first into sort of smartphones, but it really took the market and it shook it up. And I suspect that the same is going to happen here. And I think the other interesting thing about the iPad is that people are saying, well, it's a bit of a toy computer, isn't it? It's a bit silly. But actually, there's two groups of people who would really like a nice, simple computer like that. The older people who haven't used a computer before or who don't like using a computer because it's really, frankly, rather confusing, and young people who've never come across a computer before and, again, find all the sort of arcane instructions and things and peculiar words perplexing and sort of a bit off-putting. So there's a lot of potential there for, you know, books that older people would like to read, you know, if you get it into a good format, and books that younger people could read.
In lovely large print.
Reflowable print if it does, yes.
Now, there's another aspect of this, Jamie, isn't there, which is royalties, which is a very fought-over territory at the moment. I know Ian McEwan signed a deal with Amazon only this week, didn't he?
Yeah, well, actually with Rosetta Books, who in turn have a deal with Amazon.com for selling e-books. I think it's for his first five titles, and it's America only. But he is cut out his publisher of, you know, of that deal for the ebooks on those early titles.
Do you feel threatened by this? As the person who owns backlists of quite a few well-known authors.
Ian McEwan, so I haven't had a conversation with Ian about, you know, the thinking behind it. And I can see, you know, on the face of it, you can understand why an author and the author's agent who's advising on how to maximise that author's earnings might do something like that. I think it's, you know, I think there's an important appreciation that needs to be had of the kind of role of the publisher beyond just printing the book and distributing it, which are two of the elements that the ebook removes, which is one of the reasons that there have been arguments put forward, and, you know, most recently with Amos and Beaver saying the thing I read was like 75% or 70% they were saying as would be a fair split, you know, that all these changes going on, as I said, this move from analog to digital is challenging lots of the models that have been in place for many years in publishing, and some of them are outdated and need to change. And this whole thing of what is a fair ebook royalty is a contested subject.
What is the rate now? Just to compare it, it's about sort of 15% now, is it, that the author gets?
Well, it varies. Kind of historically, the hardback royalty starts at 10% of cover price, rising to 12.5%, rising to 15% at various thresholds. You know, once you've sold more than 5,000 copies of a hardback, you go up to the next escalator. And paperbacks typically are 7.5% of the cover price, again, rising to 10% after a certain chunk of sales. The ebook royalty that's becoming increasingly the kind of norm, as far as I'm aware, and what we offer all our authors is 25% of net receipts. And that's, I would say, veering on the generous in terms of what the industry norms have been set at the moment. But it's, you know, there have been many, many agents very happy with that and authors, but it seems to have risen kind of particularly to the surface in the last 3 weeks. You know, it seems there's been this guy Tom Holland has kind of been sounding off and saying some quite ludicrous things, I think, about it, which show a kind of a complete, you know, a kind of naivety about what actually publishing is. But at the same time, I have some sympathy with authors, and I think there's a case that can be made, particularly with kind of books that are deep backlist titles where, you know, the publisher is making money both off the physical sales and the ebook sales, and I think there needs to be a more generous split of those proceeds.
Now, if you're an author, you might have a different view, so please do write in to us and we will try to air your views in a future edition of this podcast. Thank you both, Charles and Jamie. That's it from us for this week. Thank you, Jamie and Charles. There'll be more on the iPad on next week's technology podcast. You can find it at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. I'm Claire Armistead, and this podcast was produced by Scott Corley. Goodbye.